morning and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Thursday, June 13, 2024. Some young men and women save families trapped in towns across Sudan.
One important aspect to mention about the emergency response rooms is they've organized themselves into a structure. They have a coordination mechanism. So even when we work with them, we go through their coordination mechanism, and they are picking all these reports that are coming up of areas that have got needs.
And South Sudanese Opposition Movement Alliance calls for a total change in South Sudan.
At the beginning, we need first address the root cause of conflicts in South Sudan. And when we address those and reach an agreement on those fundamental issues, then at the end of that particular time, in that interim period, there will be a responsibility sharing.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The UN Security Council is expected to vote Thursday on a UK-backed resolution about the situation in Sudan's El Fasher town. The resolution demands that the Rapid Support Forces should stop its siege on El Fasher and for de-escalation in and around the town and the withdrawal of fighters from the city. The draft calls on the warring parties to protect civilians who want to leave El Fasher to safer areas. The resolution also calls on states supporting the rival groups to stop and for the parties to seek an immediate cessation of hostilities. We now go live to VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir for in-depth analysis on how this resolution works at the UN Security Council. Welcome, Margaret.
Thanks, John.
Just to bring us up to speed, how does a UN resolution work?
Well, in an ideal world, they adopt it and the parties get the message, the strong signal from the international community that they need to start doing something or stop doing something, and they do it. But unfortunately, for quite a while now in the Security Council, we have not heard the council speaking always with one voice, and we're not having their responses met on the ground, shall we say, listened to on the ground. Case in point, during Ramadan, the Security Council adopted a resolution calling for a ceasefire for Ramadan in Sudan, and it was never implemented by the RSF or the SAF.
And I was going to go to the second question, talking about pen holders. Pen holders always lobby very hard for the resolution to be adopted and, get more votes. Could you explain why?
So the pen holders in UN speak, that's a UN term you're using there, pen holders, that's the country on the Security Council that's in charge of that particular issue or file. So in this case, the British oversee the Sudan file on the council. They, of course, want to, lobby council members to support this draft resolution because they want to prevent a genocide from reoccurring in Darfur. I think in this building, at least, at the United Nations, we've been hearing for quite some time now that the situation is very grave in parts of Sudan, originally, just in Khartoum, then it started spreading. Now we're looking at 5 million people on the brink of famine in Al Jazeera State, in Darfur, in Khartoum, in Kordofan. So, the country is not just experiencing a cycle of bloody violence, but it's also created a humanitarian catastrophe. So the British are trying to rally the Security Council, the international community, to put their foot down and tell the two warring parties, cut it out. And you need to stop fighting, withdraw your forces, and protect civilians. It's the window is closing, let's put it this way. I was on a call with a bunch of NGOs this morning, and they're saying that really El Fasher could fall in days. So people are very terrified about what will happen if and when that happens. From what we understand, the SAF are in their barracks in El Fasher. They're near the airport. They're not out in the streets. They're certainly not protecting the people. So it's become a really, really crisis-level situation.
And back at the UN, most of the member countries are there for their national interests, and traditional allies of Sudan might, you know, either abstain or vote during the session at around 3 p.m. today. Do you expect any surprises?
You know, on this one, I don't think that I do, but I could be wrong. but I think that there is a real recognition among the 15 council members that something must be done. And I think you have, you know, three African members on the council. They don't want to see spillover into their region. You know, we already see, like, for instance, what happened with spillover from other conflicts like Libya. The whole Sahel has been kind of infected by what's happened in Libya. So you don't want to see it spread. Already there's refugees in other countries around Sudan because of the crisis. So you don't want to see that number grow either. So I think the African members should support it. We have Algeria, which represents the Arab group on the council. You know, there's a lot of talk about the United Arab Emirates supporting the RSF, sending them weapons. They're, you know, the UAE, you know, absolutely denies it. But there seems to be growing evidence from a UN panel of experts. There's also some satellite evidence from researchers at Yale University here in the United States that may implicate them. So there needs to be some pressure on the UAE, but we'll see if Algeria, as the Arab group representative, abstains or votes with it. But I think most council members want to prevent a repeat of what happened in Darfur. I've been in this building long enough to remember that situation, and nobody here wants to see a repeat of the genocide.
And you, I mean, true to your word that you've been there for quite some time,
yeah,
monitoring the situation. If you could describe the mood today among members who are preparing for, you know, voting on these resolutions at 3 p.m. our time here, how would you characterize the mood? Is it serious, tense, or what is it?
Well, I can't say that I've seen any of them yet today, so I don't know what their mood is. But I can tell you that I just came from another briefing, which is about an annual report that the United Nations puts out about children in armed conflict. And this year, the RSF and the SAF were added to this blacklist of armed groups and militaries that perpetrate crimes against children. And the report lists the SAF for being among the world's grave violators in terms of killing and maiming children and bombing schools and hospitals. You know, they've come under a lot of criticism for their indiscriminate aerial bombing in Sudan and parts of Sudan. And the RSF also landed on this blacklist for killing and maiming children, but also for recruiting and using them in their military. And we heard today that young boys of the age of 16 or less are not allowed to leave Al Fasher right now by the RSF. We also heard that the RSF was listed because of rape and sexual abuse, and they've also attacked schools and hospitals. So there are really, really grave crimes going on in Sudan, particularly right now in North Darfur, in Al Fasher, and the international community. I mean, there are calls from all corners, from NGOs, from civil society in Sudan, to please stop another genocide. And I think that we will see the Security Council mobilized today to do their part. But the question remains, is there the political will from the two generals who have started all of this to stop it? And I'm not sure that there is, because the RSF is very close to taking all of Darfur right now. I mean, this is a pivotal battle for Al Fasher. So they may choose to fight on and ignore the calls.
Well, that's a very sad situation there in Sudan. Margaret, thank you very much for bringing us up to speed on what is happening at the UN Security Council.
Thanks, John. Hopefully we'll have good news for you in the coming days.
That was Better. Margaret Bashir, VOA's UN correspondent. She was speaking to me from New York. A U.S.-based international nonprofit called Community Organized Relief Effort, working with two local non-governmental organizations in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, says families trapped inside the country are going through tough times. Charlene Chikoto, the executive director of the Community Organized Relief Effort, is calling on the international community not to forget the people of Sudan.
They are working with the local organizations, and they are the ones who get the information to the organizations that are responding. And I think one important aspect to mention about the emergency response rooms is they've organized themselves into a structure. They have a coordination mechanism. So even when we work with them, we go through their coordination mechanism, and they are picking all these reports that are coming up of areas that have got needs, and they are reaching out to the various responders who are working within those locations. So if there's needs in the areas that we work in, for example, in Khartoum, and we reach out with a program, these emergency response rooms are the ones that are able to pinpoint us to where we can respond. And I wouldn't speak for them whether they know the situation you're spoken about, but what I can say is in our, you know, our experience, we have realized that they are on top of the situation. Sometimes the need is overwhelming. They have a lot of places where they are red flagging as areas that need response, but sometimes there might not be organizations that are available with resources to support in those areas.
What are you doing to ensure there is accountability and transparency in this noble task that you are facilitating? Because in a place like Sudan where there is conflict, sometimes it's not guaranteed that you are dealing with the right person. You could be dealing with a briefcase NGO. How do you ensure that these people are really, really making good use?
What has worked for us as CORE is we have systems in place to be able to trace and to track the funding that we put in situations such as this. We have been working in such locations over a long period of time. We go to the hard places. We go to the places where perhaps the traditional responders cannot access or are not comfortable with going. So we have set up systems that enable us, you know, to be able to track and be accountable for the resources that we are giving out. So, for example, with the emergency response rooms, working with our local partners, we have a very simplified reporting system that we have put in place that actually ensures that they can report on how they've spent the funding that we give to them. We have been able to verify when it comes to the multi-purpose cash assistance that I mentioned earlier on. We have been able to verify, you know, with the list of the registered people and those that went out to the cashing agents, we've been able to verify that everybody who got the cash, you know, on paper, actually got the cash in hand. I'll also mention that another intervention that we have done in Khartoum, which has been very impactful, is supporting the women response rooms. These are a group of volunteers under the emergency response rooms, but led by women, looking at, you know, women and child issues. And for these ones, we've actually been able to give them group cash assistance where they can decide what they need to use it for, depending on the need. And some of the impact they've had is, for example, women who needed to give birth, they've been able to move them to places where they could do that safely. Some of it is moving households or women that were at risk of GBV. Some of it, they've used it, you know, for various women and child needs. And even these groups have been able to account for the resources that we've given them. So we know there's still a question that is hanging there, but from our own experience, these groups are operational on the ground. These groups are accountable, and they've shown us their systems that they put in place to make sure that all the funding that we are sending out is used for the purpose for which we have sent it, as well as accounted for.
You are operating in an environment where there is enormous donor fatigue. With the war in Ukraine and the conflict in Gaza, the attention of the world has shifted. If you have one message to donors, what would you tell them?
What I'll say is neglecting a conflict, neglecting people in need, neglecting children in need should not be the norm, as we are seeing in Sudan. The lives that we are seeing in Sudan, as I mentioned earlier on, we are at the brink of famine, or we are almost in a famine situation. the children who are going to be, whose lives are going to be lost in Sudan because of the famine and because of the war, are the same as the children in any part of the world. They deserve the assistance just like any other child. They deserve the life just like any other child. So turning a blind eye is not an option. I think the need for action is now. Now is even late, that's what I would say, because we have known as a sector that starting from June, we are entering the peak hunger season. And if we hadn't moved significantly as a sector, we'll start to see people dying from hunger. So now it's time to act. If anything, now is even late.
That's Charlene Chikoto, the executive director of the organization Community Organized Relief Effort. She was speaking to me from Harare, Zimbabwe, yesterday. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, an opposition group calls for change in South Sudan. Find out why after this break. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The leader of the South Sudan Opposition Movement Alliance is calling for formation of an interim government in South Sudan to usher a new era in the country. Lual Dao, secretary of the opposition group, says South Sudanese should hold a national constitutional conference in Kenya and South Sudan to discuss the prospects for change in the country.
At the beginning, we need first address the root cause of conflicts in South Sudan. And when we address those and reach an agreement on those fundamental issues, then at the end of that particular time, in that interim period, there will be a responsibility sharing. And that is a program of the implementation of the agreement, if at all it is reached. So in that, this to me initiative is going to be a different process altogether. We are first focusing on addressing the root cause of conflicts. When those root causes are agreed, there will be a clear implementation mechanism with timeline and clear budget and a clear program. And after that, of course, there is a need for people to run that interim period.
I will read the second last paragraph, which talks about your expectations that the Tumaini Initiative will lead to a national constitutional conference in Kenya and South Sudan. You are predicting the outcome to be an adoption of a new social contract, interim government arrangement with a rescue program, and implementation modalities. I mean, this is calling for a change, a total overhaul of the government in South Sudan. How possible is this going to be?
It is not about changing anybody or pushing anybody out, Brother John. It is about rescuing the country. And to do that, it requires a new thinking, a new direction, a new vision.
And this new thinking and this new direction appears to be sounding selfish, because the purpose of you sitting in Nairobi is to agree on how to move forward. And your proposal for moving forward is sounding like you're calling for a total overhaul of the system that is existing.
Not at all, Brother John. What we are calling here, since our country became independent in July 2011, we as South Sudanese failed to come up with a permanent constitution. And you know it very well, in order for any country to succeed, there is a need for a permanent constitution.
The 2018 peace agreement stipulates that the country must have a permanent constitution.
I know your question is very good, but if I answer it, it will just take me back on blaming X and Y for not doing it. What we are focusing on here in Nairobi through Tumuini Initiative, it is to focus forward with a new thinking and a new direction, which focus on solutions. And the solution at this particular time, we believe, in order to have a fair and a credible election in South Sudan, there is a need for us to come up as South Sudanese to develop a permanent constitution. So we are calling the government delegation here, the stakeholders, and ourselves as opposition group for a national constitutional conference, which will bring all the stakeholders, youth, women, opposition group, government, and civil society. We sit, we agree as a people of South Sudan, develop a constitutional text, which eventually will lead into a permanent constitution.
How would you react to your critics who would say SOMA is digging potholes on the road to peace at the Tumaini Initiative?
Brother John, you know the agreement was signed in 2018 and now it is 2024. We have been outside of that agreement. Those who are running it, if they are implementing it, there will be no even need for SOMA. It has nothing to do with us, but I respect their opinion. I am here in the public arena. I respect to be criticized. I respect to be blamed. That one is normal. But the truth of the matter is, this agreement was not implemented by people who signed it. And what we are trying to do here in Nairobi is to rescue the country and rescue the people who even signed it, so that we, the people of South Sudan, come together now in a different thinking and a different direction.
I was in Juba last month. To be specific, I was there from the 13th of May to the 18th. So I spoke to a few individuals who told me they want elections done today and not tomorrow so that they can vote some people out. And you're saying, no, the country is not conducive for elections. I can see a clash here between you and the people you are fighting for.
There is no clash. For me, I even won election done since 2015. The question is, what kind of election are you going to run, Brother John? If you want a fair, peaceful, and credible election, there is no way you can do it in South Sudan at this particular time. But if you just want to run an election that could result into chaos and even a total disintegration of our country, then yes, you can run that election.
That's Lual Dao, Secretary of the South Sudan Opposition Groups. He spoke to me via WhatsApp from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, earlier today. The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, reports global forced displacement surged to historic heights last year, driven by conflict, persecution, human rights violations, climate crisis, and other disturbing events. Lisa Schrein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UNHCR reports 117.3 million people were forcibly displaced worldwide by the end of 2023. More than half, 68.3 million people, were uprooted from their homes by conflict and are displaced inside their own countries. At least 31.6 million more people have fled for safety across borders as refugees. The report finds the number of forcibly displaced continued to rise this year and now stands at more than 120 million. It says a key factor driving these surging numbers is the conflict in Sudan. At the end of last year, United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi says conflict had uprooted a total of 10.8 million people in Sudan from their homes. He says now the number of internally displaced alone has risen to nearly 10 million, and 2 million have sought refuge abroad.
I can speak more about Sudan. I am very keen to single it out first because I think it is a crisis that generally doesn't really make it to the headline. It's a very forgotten crisis, although it's one of the most catastrophic ones, not just in terms of displacement, but in terms of hunger, lack of access, violation of human rights, and so forth.
Other crises that have created a spike in new forced displacements are the conflicts in Myanmar and Gaza. And then there are what the report calls the endless conflicts that continue to displace people. They include Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Somalia. Repressive governments and economic crises are forcing some to flee their homes in Venezuela and Nicaragua as well. Grandi says population movements are complex and a result of diverse factors. For example, he says conflict is often sparked by the impact of climate change on people's livelihoods.
It can be a driver of conflict and hence of displacement, especially when, you know, the very scarce resources of poor communities become even scarcer than because of climate change, that drives conflict. We've seen it in so many parts in Africa, in the Sahel, for example, in the Horn of Africa, but also elsewhere.
The report debunks a common perception that all refugees go to rich countries. The UNHCR says most refugees are hosted in countries neighboring their own. It says 75% live in low and middle-income countries that together produce less than 20% of the world's income. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
From Geneva, we move to Kenya, where a public-private partnership in Kenya is providing female students with free sanitary napkins that are dispensed from converted ATMs at schools. The goal is to provide students from poor families with sanitary pads so that they do not have to miss school because they are menstruating. Victoria Amonga reports from Nairobi.
Often female students in Kenya who come from poor families are forced to miss school during menstruation because the price of sanitary pads out of reach. But the Kenyan aid group called Slum Sana launched an initiative at a Nairobi high school in May that provides free pads for female students. Here is how they're dispensed to students at schools. Each girl is given a special card they can use at an ATM machine that has been converted to dispense sanitary pads. Alfin Juma is the program coordinator for Slum Sana.
Each girl is allocated at least 8 to 16 pads per cycle, meaning every time they want to use the pads, they can be able to do that as long as they have their cards. Another thing is that if they don't have their cards, let's say they forget it at home or someone misplaces them, the teachers are given an extra card.
The Kenyan government says studies show girls from poor families miss 20% of school days each year because they do not have sanitary pads. The pad dispenser machine can hold up to 36 pads and run on solar power in remote areas, says Munira Twahir, the creator of what's called Ari the Pad ATM.
Technology is very important in solving these problems, especially in the space that we're in, which is menstrual health management. There's not a lot of hardware technology or hybrid technology to solve it. So I think this allows for students to have autonomy, so we cut off the middleman.
Officials say the initiative is being implemented in Nairobi and they hope to expand it to other parts of the country too. Quinta Atieno is one of the about 1,200 students who officials say have a pad dispenser card.
It's going to help us maintain being in school. Now you see most of our parents are not going to be required to buy the sanitary pads themselves since it's easily accessible in school.
A 2017 law, Kenya says female students who reach puberty must be provided free sanitary pads, but educators say a lack of access continues to be a big problem and affects students who cannot afford them. Mary Lonyangapoi is a school principal.
Our girls suffer from low self-esteem because of those issues of begging from people. They beg from the teachers who are in school. They even come to the principal's office to say they don't have a pad and they are on their menses. And we've tried to support as many as possible, but the numbers are beyond our ability.
Activists are pressing Kenya to waive taxes on sanitary pads to lower the cost. Until then, advocates say technologies like the pad dispenser help lift the burden from the girls and allow them to attend class just like other students. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
That report by Victoria Munga wraps up what we prepared for you today, Thursday, June 13, 2024. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Bill Bass, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Thank you.